I'm your host, Whit Schiller, and ready to share this episode of Improv Comedy Connection, which features Billy Merritt. Billy's a longtime improviser. He's got deep experience and a ton of insight into the mind of improvisers. He, along with fellow UCBer Will Hines, came out with this really interesting book called Pirate Robot Ninja, An Improv Fable. It's a quirky and fun read, and clearly one or both of the authors are foodies, but it's also full of some great insights on improv comedy. You'll see a lot of the UCB's approach in the book, but improvisers of any style or approach will learn a lot about themselves and working with others. I think you'll get a real good flavor for that in this episode, so let's get right to the Billy Merritt episode of Improv Comedy Connection. Billy Merritt, it is very good to speak with you today.
It's good to be spoken to.
I am really excited to talk about your book, Pirate Robot Ninja, An Improv Fable.
Yeah.
I got it really early on and finished it really early on. It's an interesting take on it. I'm not sure there's another book quite like it.
Good.
And it certainly is, yeah, and it certainly is very specific to a philosophy that I understand that you developed and then fleshed out with Will Hines. But before we get into that, because we'll spend a fair amount of time on that book, I'd like to chat a little bit about the way that you started in improv was a little bit different than most. Can you just share, like in Florida, where you grew up, right?
Yeah. I grew up in Florida, went to University of Florida, but wasn't involved in the theater or anything. I got into actually theater and improv later in life, probably in my late 20s. Went back to school, wandered into the theater building because I thought it was the cafeteria. So I was searching for food and found theater. Started doing shows at Palm Beach State College, studying there. And that's where I met a couple friends, and we were all big comedy nerds. That phrase wasn't used back then. This is in the early 90s. So people didn't say comedy nerd, but we all knew SCTV and Monty Python. Yeah. Stuff like that. And we started doing improv together, but we were figuring out on our own. We did not take classes. We basically had the book, Viola Spillane's book. We saw Second City touring companies when they came into town in West Palm Beach. So we kind of figured it out on our own. And looking back on it, I would say we were atrocious, but we thought we were good.
Well, you're starting from a book, and Spillane's book I don't think it's the easiest book to read.
It isn't really. We took it, and also at that time, we took it as an actor getting into improv, not a comedian doing improv. So we were reading it and exploring it a little bit differently. But also SCTV and sketch comedy, we always loved that style of comedy, and we knew that that's what we wanted to do. And we eventually started doing our own shows. I think our first sketches were literally stolen from SC Torco shows. I think we stole their sketches. We obviously learned early on that that's not what you do. But we got to the point where, you know, we had to go somewhere. If this is what we want to do, we have to go somewhere where they're teaching it. And it was either Chicago, which is a big improv town, obviously, or New York, where there's some improv, but there's more acting. And I think we chose New York because we were actors and improvisers. And then we got involved with the scene there. And that was before UCB was in New York. So it was really kind of a dead land as far as long form improv goes.
You had a couple short form theaters at that time, right?
Yeah. In New York, there was Chicago City Limits, which is probably the big name there. Groundlings had a version of their theater called Gotham City. And myself, Michael Delaney, a couple other people. Michael Delaney is a teacher and performer in New York, UCB. We joined the National Improv Theater through a recommendation. And they're really good. It just turned out that they were signed Scientologist, and nobody told us that.
How long did it take to figure that out?
Oh, the first day. We got it, but we'd moved to New York, and honestly, they taught a good class, and they had a great little theater, and they gave us space, and they were nice, and they didn't force themselves on us. It just turns out, like, you know, by the end of the year, they owed us a lot of money. But besides that, you know, I don't have anything bad to say about the theater. I met a lot of good people there, and then they folded up and moved to LA, and then we were about, let's say we spent a year in New York kind of on our own, just trying to figure out how to do improv until UCB came. And that was probably the best training we got, is when the UCB4 finally came to New York and gave us, we wanted to learn the Herald. And at that time, mid 90s, nobody in New York that we knew could teach the Herald. Finally, they showed up and taught us the Herald that we wanted to know.
So when did you have this idea that that's what kind of training you wanted?
I think I saw their show, and I tell this to my classes now. It's like, go see there's so many shows to see. Go see shows, and when you see a show and you go, that's what I want to do. And I remember sitting at a bar, and they were doing their, what is now called their ASCAT show in Chicago. I believe it's called the Armando. It's a monologue deconstruction forum. form. We saw them do that show, and me and Michael and a couple other people said, that's it. That's what we want. We want to play that way. And we asked them if they did workshops, and it turns out they did.
And what was it that drew you to that over what you had been doing before?
It was real. They were playing themselves. They were playing from the inside out. Their comedy was observational and honest, and you weren't pitching jokes at the audience. I later learned that it didn't have that ironic detachment, that little nod and wink that you have to have with the audience sometimes when you do short form, which I'm really good at. I was just talking about this the other day. It's about the mantra that I fought for the longest time. Just because they're laughing doesn't mean you're doing it right. You're going for the first laugh, not the best laugh. And the best laugh means you have to play it real, play it honest, let the audience relate, and then hit them with the comedy and then find that pattern. And then once I did that, it's like, oh man, this feels like a very nice suit. I really like this style a lot.
Do you think that's a choice in philosophy versus a short form versus long form sensibility?
I'm sorry, what do you mean by philosophy?
Well, so like one of the things that you said, and I may not quote you exactly right, but basically sure. That you wanted to play it real and authentic, and
yes,
I think you
yeah.
said from the inside out, right?
Yeah.
And one way you could view that is that you're going to have a deeper connection with the audience. They'll relate more to the humor as opposed to you said something clever that they
yeah.
appreciate.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm only giving you my perception, my point of view. I think there's fantastic short form. There still is, and there will always be great short form shows that are very realistic. The way I learned it was we played theater games, and it was a difference of feeling you had to be on stage. Whoever the smartest person on stage was won the scene versus yeah. what I learned this style was, no, we're doing the scene together. We're not trying to win it. We're not trying to be better than each other. We're trying to find the scene together. And another way for me personally was, for the first time doing long form improv, I would do a scene, then I could throw it away and not worry about it because another one will come. Whereas in my short form days, I would do those same jokes over and over. I knew it got a laugh, I'd go for it.
When you say that you would do the same jokes over and over again, you had like,
yeah.
Stock characters or stock
yeah.
moves that you would
stock
do?
Stock characters, certain sayings. If you're playing party quirks, there's a couple things you can do that you know will always get a laugh because you're there to entertain and you're there, you know, it's not like... I had to tell myself, look, I'm not a horrible person. I'm entertaining. People are having a good time. But for me, it wasn't as exciting as walking away after doing a long form show going, wow, what was that? Where did that go? I didn't expect it to go there. You know, so there
yeah.
was a big difference to me going from one to the other. I will say this, and I tell this to all my classes, learn short form because all the tools you learn in short form only make your long form better. All those quick short tools of like doing little teeny things like split screen or dubbing or this or that, any of that stuff is going to help you with your long form improv.
Another thing that I heard you talk about somewhere out there in probably the podcast ecosystem was about something that I think you're kind of known for, and that is creating and exploring and experimenting with different forms for long form.
Yeah.
To me, I think there could be some elements of trying to kind of flesh out the art form that way. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that's important? And I think it's almost like you have a certain goal in mind by going through all these different forms.
Yeah, there are many different forms. I'm actually just pitched a show called Build a Show where the class will decide what kind of form we're going to do by doing a lot of small exercises and putting those together and turn them into a form. The idea of form, I think you go back to, if we're talking about finding the game of the scene, UCB, what is funny about this scene? What's the pattern of this scene? What's the structure of this scene? Then form is the game of the show. What's the structure of this show? In other words, why are we seeing the show in the first place? The Herald is a great trainer form. It teaches you three scenes, group game, three scenes, group game, which gives you classic A story, B story, C story, and returning to those stories. But then there are different styles, like the documentary form, which is more realistic in the sense that you're playing real people that are on camera, but you're catching yourself doing real things on camera. It's a different style of acting. And the best way to describe that would be The Office or Parks and Rec, that style of acting. And
right.
I think that form plays to that style. Tonight, we're doing a improvised one-act play. There are many ways to do it, but we do it genre-based. So we figure out what genre we're going to do ahead of time, and the form is decided by the genre. For instance, a Tennessee Williams style has many different techniques that you do within that form versus a David Mamet style versus some other style.
Do you think there's also an element of those different forms, or when you, well, maybe we'll just kind of focus on genre or maybe even narrative-based improv. Yeah. Do you think because the audience has more handholds, it's easier for a non-improviser audience member to kind of grab onto what you're doing?
I think so. Yeah, I think like if you do Tennessee Williams well, they'll laugh at the first Southern joke that you do. But what I usually teach is don't do Tennessee Williams to get jokes because you're doing Tennessee Williams. That connects with your audience. Now bring them into the scene more by finding story. Like do a really good story. Don't just pull off Tennessee Williams. Do a great story in that genre. And I think you bring up a very good thing that I'm really pushing now is as improv grows, we tend to do, I see a lot of shows where improvisers are doing improv shows for other improvisers. And it has affected my teaching by going, and I have this mantra that I say in every class, yeah, but does dad in the back row watching your show know what's going on? And we've got to make sure our improv is digestible for the whole audience, not just for other improvisers.
So what do you do to help dad?
Empathy, right up front, create a real life, something that the audience can connect with. Like, I know that guy. Really start, it's a very simple thing. And I'm amazed how much my students refuse to do it. And it's called naming each other and naming the location and using, in the book, we talk about flash memory, use bits of your real life in your scene and somebody in that audience will connect. If you talk about going to the lake house, that's one thing. But if you talk about going to Arrowhead Lake, which is a lake here in New York, or, and where am I? California. People will go, oh, I know that lake. Now they're going to care a little bit more about that scene because they can see it a little bit more. So it goes back to the old note, specifics. The more specific you can be, the easier it is for the audience to understand where you are and what you're doing, and the easier it is for them to empathize. And then once you've got them on board with empathy, then you hit them with a comedy. And then that's when they get that bigger laugh.
So on the specifics, do you think it's as important that they know where or what Arrowhead Lake is, or that you have identified a lake and it's your personal connection to that memory that drives things forward?
It's a little bit of both. And again, it goes to the book, depending if you're a pirate or a robot. A pirate will use their flash memory, like I've been in this location, I can live in this world. Whereas a robot needs to know that information, knows where Lake Arrowhead is and what popular things are there to do at Lake Arrowhead and things like that. So we're all different people and we all approach it differently. I, of course, come from the gut, more of a pirate. So it's like I feel the scene more than I think the scene.
You've had this theory that has been kind of percolating for quite a while, right?
Yeah. I started it teaching almost 20 years. This is my 20-year anniversary of teaching at UCB, which is scary to think about.
Yeah.
And I just found, I was just writing something about this. My first 5 years, I was just trying not to be a disaster. I was like, I didn't think I deserved to teach. I just wanted to be like, make sure I was okay. My second 5 years, my ego kind of took over. It's like, I'm good at this. I know what I'm doing. My third 5 years is like, oh my God, what am I? Just a teacher? That's all I'm doing. And now my last 5 years is I'm completely happy. This is where I'm happiest. I love teaching. This is what I want to do. I would say by about year six is when I realized, this note is getting to half my class, but not the other half. Or this exercise, this group gets, but this group can't stand. And I'm realizing I can't give the same note or the same lesson to every single student. Each one learns differently. And I went back to my old psych classes and kind of focused on left side of the brain, right side of the brain. And I thoroughly believe that creatively, we're either more analytical or more impulsive. We tend to lean one way or the other, left side, right side. Some of us prefer to get on stage analytically, want to know every move, make all those moves and state all those moves. And some of us just want to get out there and play impulsively, throw it out there, learn from your mistakes kind of thing.
And of course, that's a binary description that you're giving, but nobody is all the way to the left or to the right.
Yeah, it's not all or none. It's just you lean one way or the other. But yeah, you've got to find some sort of structure. So it's easier to go binary than it is. The more if you go even further, it gets a little more confusing to your class.
Do you think that certain schools will pull in more pirates versus robots?
I wonder about that. I mean, I constantly tell people, take in L.A. right now, there's Second City, Groundlings. There was I.O. for a while, and UCB. If you have the time and the money, take a class everywhere and figure out what works best for you. That's an interesting question. I wonder if that's... I can only compare Groundlings and here. My feeling is Groundlings is more of a piratey type thing. But I'm sure somebody at Groundlings would disagree. But I think that, yeah.
I mean, there's a, I don't know, and not having gone through it, but knowing some folks who have, I've heard, you know, character is more of a driver. You hear Chicago improv. Yeah. There's a number of places you might say are more kind of relationship driven. UCB gets the label of being focused on game, but it's also got a manual and it's a textbook, is really what it is, which seems like a very robot-y kind of tool and resource.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. It's analytically explaining how to do the game, but I've been teaching for 20 years and all I teach at UCB is relationship. So, once you've got the thing is, it's not one or the other. It's got to be both. That's what the ninja idea behind that whole philosophy is. You can't have structure without relationship. You can't have rhythm without pattern. You can't have yin without yang is where I'm coming from. If you look in the book, the manual, the textbook, like I tell my classes, it's not a beach read. It is literally a textbook that you use as a reference guide. The first thing you need to do to start a scene, to find a game of the scene, is create a base reality. That is relationship. That is the truth. The truth in a scene will get you to the unusual. And if you can't do that, you can't play the game. So we spend the whole, our whole curriculum goes from 101 to 401. All 101 is about who are you, where are you, your object and space work, laying down that foundation of truth so that you can find the unusual and turn that into a game. And I still get students in advanced classes that I keep saying, you know, you're dropping your relationship. You're only focusing on the what, not the who and the where. You're not going to get a full, complete game if you don't do that.
Yeah, your book is, thinking back on the read, there are elements or times where you're providing kind of notes as to, well, it's either a pirate or a robot thing to drop names or pass by this offer or whatever it might be. What's more important, to know that you have these tendencies or to know that others that you're performing with have tendencies that might be different than yours?
I think the core idea of the whole philosophy, or when I teach, if I teach a one-day workshop about it, is it always starts from the inside out. It starts with you first. So, and it's not a selfish thing. It's always find out where your strengths are, shore up your strengths. So in other words, are you more analytical or are you more impulsive? Know where you're coming from so that you can then work on your weaknesses from a point of strength. And then once you've done that and you feel comfortable in that world, your job is to make everybody better. Eventually, it's not even about people, it's the scene itself. So when you reach total balance, when you reach the ninja world, it's not about ego anymore. It's not about people, it's about the scene. It's about what's going on at this moment and what needs to be done to make it work. And you don't think you do. That's the trick there, is don't think about it anymore. By the time you've completed this, you just simply do what needs to be done to make that scene work.
Yeah. Absorb all the rules, all the philosophy, all the aspects, and then forget it all.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I have also talked about in classes that I have different roles for different teams. Some teams, I tend to be more of a pirate, where it's like, I'll just throw myself out there. I know you guys will catch me. In other shows and other forms, I find I need to be more robotic. I need to be more of a sheepdog and kind of set up the scenes for everybody else. So that's me taking stock of what kind of show this is, what is my role in the show, and to play that role to the best of my ability.
And you try to do that consciously?
Yeah, at the start I do. When I'm in a zone, I'm not thinking, I just do. Like this show I'm doing tonight, like I said, is improvised one act, highly thinking show, because I have to think about what is the genre that we're going to do. And we're trying to get to the point where we don't know the genre until we get a title from the audience. So there's a lot of thinking going on up front.
Sure.
To kind of figure out what that genre is and how to play it. And then the trick is to, how do we turn this into a play and still move it forward and still play moments? So this is a good example of this show. I'm heavily thinking. I'm heavily robotic. I'm not in my comfort zone yet with it. That's why I love it, because it's making me, when I'm more comfortable in the form, it's the funnest thing that I can do because it's challenging.
When you're performing, are you typically performing with people with somewhat similar levels of experience or skills, or does it vary?
I've done it long enough where I just play with old people now. Early shows, but I can get home by 10. I don't do the midnight shows. I don't drink on stage anymore.
You're not doing jams?
God, no. Nothing wrong with those. That was the best part of my life. It was so fun to do. But after 20 years, I'm happy to do a 7 o'clock show and be home by 9. That's a good day. I'm very fortunate to play with people who've got a lot of experience behind them. And I feel very comfortable with everybody I play with.
But you're teaching a variety of levels.
Yes.
Do you think there's a different application of pirate robot if you have mixed levels of experience in terms of the more experienced person pulling along someone or understanding where some of the choices or misses or what have you may come
from?
Yeah,
I mean, I teach 101 all the way up to academy or advanced levels. I don't really teach too much Pirate Robot 101 through 101 to 301, because that's a set curriculum and I believe in a curriculum. So I teach that. Now, while I'm teaching it, I realize in my back of my head, it's like, this person needs this approach. This person needs that approach to understand what I'm trying to tell them to do. But I often give the big speech before every class about respect, about carrying each other over the finish line, to allow ourselves to be comfortable enough in class to be vulnerable, to hear what's being said so you can react naturally to it. And that seems right now to make classes much, they seem to be going further when I do that. And it's like, I wish I did this 20 years ago. It took me this long to figure it out, is just to make people totally comfortable in their skin on stage. So I don't need to tell them in 101 and 201 what kind of improviser they are. You know, that would get them in their head even more. Now, by 401 or advanced study or academy, then I tell you what's wrong with you. I tell you, fix this now, you know.
For 8 weeks, here's what's wrong with you.
Yeah, exactly, you know. Because by the time people get advanced study, they're trying to play it safe. They're just trying to go up through the system to get on a Herald team. Not everybody, but a lot of people are. And then I just see people not making the mistakes and not learning from their mistakes. They're just trying to do every scene the way they know. Like, I can tell when they're trying to do a scene the way I want them to, not the way they want to do the scene. And it's like, no, how would you do that scene? Play it real.
How much different are the students, the new improvisers today versus when you started?
Oh, you want me to get into, in my day?
Well, I'm not much different than your day.
It has changed dramatically, and for good and bad, both ways. In my day, the grumbling is people aren't working as hard. Literally, we used to rehearse 2 times a week, 3 hours a day. Now it's once a week for 2 hours for many different reasons. We were more nerds to the form because that might be a Hollywood, New York thing. People weren't trying to get agents with this when we first started. We were just basically people who just got out of Magic the Gathering and wanted to try something else. A lot of D&D nerds, a lot of LARPing or a lot of fantasy type stuff. That's kind of where we were. Now we've opened up, and my last few classes have been just unbelievably 50-50, male, female, people of color, just everybody. It's a much more universal class, and it should have been this way for 20 years, and I feel horrible that it hasn't been. But I am seeing the class be much more supportive with each other, less, for want of a better word, less masculine, less, you know, and I'm a very, I'm a masculine guy. I give each other gruff all the time. I love being that way. Yeah. But I have learned that puts some people off, and I can't do that until they know me. Then they know who I am, and they know I'm a blowhard, and they'll be fine with it. And I have found a good place for me as a teacher, and I have found so many great students since then that my classes that are completely mixed are just the best classes that I have. Also, ageism. I'm getting older people that are doing classes that are just simply brilliant and wonderful, that have such great stories to tell. And that's not something I've seen before. So I would say, you know, if I could mix the both worlds, I would love the people to work as hard as we did when we first discovered this stuff 20 years ago, but with everybody that we have that's involved now.
So let's get back to some of the comments about ethic of, you know, working, rehearsing, have you. How much of that do you think is that the art form itself has been fleshed out more and more formalized or structured so there's less discovery?
That's a good point. It very well could be, but there's learning technique and then there's learning scene work. Technique doesn't take as much time. When I first moved to New York, and this is, again, going back to National Improv Theater, those lovely Scientologists, they're incredibly technique driven. So we took 2 3-hour classes a week. That's how they taught. One class would be on technique, learning all the tools of knowing who you are and where you are and split screen and dubbing and puppeting and all these little exercises. And then the other one was scene work. And scene work can go on forever. Scene work is not something you go in, do a couple scenes, and you're done. Of course, you know, we were told by hippies, you know, in the 90s and the early aughts, back in their day in the committee in San Francisco, they were doing heralds that were 4 hours long, and they would go into the mountains to rehearse, and they would take acid and not come back for 30 days. And it's like, all right, calm down, Grandpa. So, I mean, I get it's an age thing, but I really feel a group needs to be with each other for more than 2 hours just to loosen up enough to do just scene work that has nothing to do with technique, but just scene work and getting to know each other.
In the book, you made a choice to write this in a fable form.
Yes.
You had this this thing, I think, on the Improv Resource Center. There was that kind of vibe to some of the ways you would write some of your notes or observations or thoughts.
Yeah, I guess that's where it came from. It really came from Will, the person who did the bulk of the work as far as writing and structuring, because he had written a book before called How to Be the World's Greatest Improviser.
A great book.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. And he just wonderful person, self-effacing at times. It was just like going, nobody reads that book. And I was like, I beg to differ. And he says, well, what's your favorite part of the book? It's like, well, yeah, I haven't read it. Sure. the idea is he felt he didn't want to write another improv book, which just talking about improv for improvisers, and wanted to make it more of a story. And of course, that's right up my alley. I told him I would love to at some time, and we really couldn't afford it. But this book, in my mind, was written like a graphic novel, like a graphic novel. If we could have illustrated it more and made it like a comic book, I would be even happier. But that would take twice the time and twice the money to put together.
Yeah, you put a few illustrations in there.
Yeah. And of course, after we got a few, we would love to do more. So the idea is, yeah, we have a series of things that we want to get across, but how can we make it more interesting? Let's turn it into a journey and move it forward. And again, it's doing two things at once, talking about improv lessons, but putting it in some sort of fable or journey as you move forward.
And I will tell you, and stick with me to the end of this comment, I picked it up in part because knowing Will and his book and knowing a little bit about you, I thought this was going to be a book that would be worth going through. When I saw it was a fable, I thought, I'm gonna really have trouble with this. And it's just not typically my style. But
sure.
I warmed up to it a lot, and I would encourage those who haven't read it. One of the things that I think is very helpful is you're able to put yourself in a student's position. Even if you're far along, I've been improvising for about 20 years myself, just to have that reflection back and the way people go through things. I thought you did a really nice job of giving that class experience in a book form.
Oh, good. Thanks, man. I hope that's what came across. We took a big leap turning it into a story. But I think it was Will that came up with all the different types of, we call the student seekers.
Yep.
But we have a list, because we talk about pirate and robot, there are many other kinds of seekers. And I think we have 7 out of 20 that we wrote up. I think we picked 7 specific type of students that he and I have felt over the last few years.
And how did you pick those 7? Based on what would fit the story or what you thought was most common?
Yeah, by what kind of questions a student might ask about a certain lesson that we're teaching. I think we have one as a seething seeker who's always angry all the time, because we always get one of those people in, not in every class, but there's always one or two people every year that'll be in class and will get just like maybe somebody who's improvised before and doesn't like being taught a different way. So they're more resistant to other people. The eager seeker is my favorite character. And that's the one that their hand goes up first. They get on stage to do the very first scene, and they're great. But some, you know, I'll leave it there. I don't want to...
Well, that's the other part of it. When you think back to those initial classes that, you know, all of us took, you could personalize that to, oh yeah, that's so-and-so. So,
oh, sure.
So the baseline, we've kind of talked about that a little bit, about having your foundation. You talked about that as being kind of a pyramid. And then you get into these pillars and the 4 pillars of a good scene.
Yeah.
Was this part of the robot pirate philosophy that you had created and taught in your classes, or was this a construct that you came up with to fit the book?
We fit the book, and it was clearly a pirate and robot working together. Will being a robot saying we need to teach in structure. Students learn as far as structure goes. He talked about a book called the 4 Agreements. We talked about all these self-help books that have some sort of structure this or that. It's just easier to get your point across. I came up with the idea of, pillars. I've always heard pillars of humanity for acting. You need the 7 pillars and this and that. So I've heard that reference before. And then when we labeled it, I thought Earth, Wind, and Fire, because that was my favorite band growing up. So that's where that came from. And we just built off of that. So that was a collaboration, but has nothing to do with class. That was us, as we were writing the book, wanting to get these points across. That's Will creating a structure to put it in.
Water had somehow gotten dropped when Earth, Wind, and Fire really started to take off, too.
Yes.
You have a fourth pillar.
Yeah, that was literally it. Well, we got to have a fourth pillar. I don't know. What is it about? Water. Editing.
I noticed that in what you guys go through, and you know, I'm not going to go through the whole book because people should pick it up and look at it. It seemed to me that the most treatment was in the area of heightening.
What do you mean by treatment?
I guess kind of the length or the amount of attention. So for instance, in your Pillar of Earth, you have a couple of lessons or kind of mini chapters on how a pirate would approach that pillar and how a robot would approach that pillar.
Gotcha, yeah.
In heightening, I think if I tracked it right, you've got three of each. Three kind of mini chapters or lessons on heightening for pirate and for robot.
It might be because the bulk of my teaching, and also Will might have a different point of view, but I just came out of a class where I had this conversation, was knowing what the game of the scene is not the scene. It's like learning the lines of a play. Once you learn the lines, then the real acting goes into play. Once you learn the game of the scene, then the real comedy comes, but that comes through heightening. So heightening is the key to gameplay. Just knowing the game of the scene isn't funny. That's not where the comedy is. It's hitting that pattern and putting your skill to hitting that pattern. And that's heightening. How do we get crazier or weirder, or that if that then what else factor? How can we start writing jokes? And that's what heightening is. It's a long conversation we've had back and forth.
Yeah. And maybe it was also there were certain aspects that you had from your classes and the instruction. I know, like the keep the music, change the lyrics. I think that was in Will's book, How to Be the Greatest Improviser on Earth.
Yeah.
That's something he's talked about as well. I'm assuming that was kind of his chapter. That's a robot chapter.
Absolutely, yeah.
I felt like he also was trying to almost pull back on it. It was kind of like, hey, you may not like this. But there is certainly a lot of validity to that choice in the right setting to heighten a scene.
Yeah, yeah. I think also justification was in that. Is that part of the heightening? Yeah, that's huge for me. And I'm having a big battle. It's not a real big battle. I think a lot of people say you don't need justification for comedy to get to the unusual. And it's like, yes, absolutely you don't. But it makes it better if you know the why. I think too many people get the who, the where, the what, but they don't get the why. The why gives you the theme, tells us why we're seeing a joke in the first place. And that's part of heightening, finding that why. That really good justification allows you to heighten and go further. And again, that goes back to why I like forms so much. Forms help you develop justifications. They help you tell the story without having to tell the story. And I think that's important. Knowing why this is happening is a big thing for me.
Well, and also justification, I agree with that. I think justification also grounds you over and over again, so that you don't all of a sudden find yourself, you know, a million miles away from what the dad in the back of the room can understand.
And also, I'm not saying that you have to sit down in every scene and going, why is this happening? Sometimes a justification is just a knowing nod, but sometimes it does need some sort of reasoning. It's not you got to teach some manner or way. So we always say justify. That doesn't mean you have to literally say why the unusual is happening. Yeah. I always ask my students to watch a sketch, their favorite sketch on YouTube. Don't watch it once, watch it five times. After you quit laughing, start analyzing it. Figure out the why. Mm-hmm. Get the who and the where and the what. But why is this joke being written? Where is this coming from? What's the approach? Once you do that, all of a sudden premise becomes so much easier to lay down.
To lay down in terms of letting it go or to create it?
It gives you a motivation as to where that premise is coming from. It gives you a philosophy. I think that's the other way to look at it. You know, the old philosophy is a great justification. And when you have a good philosophy, if your character has a good philosophy, you've got a good character, you know, and you'll always have something to say on stage if you got a good philosophy behind what your character is doing.
So the last pillar, a pillar of water, was an editing. That's what the pillar is editing.
Yeah.
Editing is obviously an important skill, particularly in long-form improv.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about what goes into being a good editor?
Well, it's going to be cliche, but I'm going to say listening, hearing the scene, knowing the move, teaching yourself to anticipate, knowing to kill a scene 7 seconds before it knows it's dead. It's a ninja move. And editing, it's a giant category. It doesn't just mean ending a scene. It means coming in and supporting a scene as well. It means tag outs. It means cut twos. It means all the little things that you do to make that scene better that you can do without being seen. That's a good improviser. An improviser that you don't see making those moves. In other words, moves like water is the idea. I think it's an old, is it Bruce Lee? Be water? I can't remember the phrase. I should get a tattoo. And it's like the first thing we teach in editing is like a non-conformist run completely across stage, sweep edit. Don't raise your hands. Don't clap. Don't make it about you. Just run across stage like a graceful gazelle. Because as I said about Dad in the back row, the first time you run across stage, Dad goes, "What was that?" The second time, he goes, "Oh, that's an editing device so they can move to the next scene." The third time you run across stage, he doesn't see it anymore. And now you can continue with the show. And this goes back to teaching an audience what they're about to see. So that's where those edits come into play. That's the importance of for the audience to see that. But as you get better and better with editing, then you call I call something like fanciful edits, ways to end scenes that aren't abrupt. They might meld into another scene, or that scene might just morph into a different game and a different scene. That's also editing.
There's a passage in Mick Napier's book where at least I've heard of him talking about his first long form improv show that he went as an audience member.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've heard this, but he talks about how he was confused by having a back line and the editing. And I didn't get the sense that he had it figured out by edit number 3.
Really?
Well, he didn't say that, but the impression I got was he left the show and found all of that still a bit confusing. Obviously, he got over it.
Yeah.
Because he's been doing that a while. But do you think some of the different editing or the more natural, organic edits that you're talking about are maybe to be more tied to the moment as opposed to having a certain technique?
I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, that's your ultimate goal, is to have your editing tied to the moment and being part of the show. We do a form in the Smokes in the second half where we do a 30-minute set with no editing, only transfers from within the scene. So you can walk into the scene, you can tap someone out, but you don't swipe the stage or clear the stage. And it kind of tells its own story that way. It's challenging, but it's a lot of fun. It's challenging at first, but as you get going, you know, you don't even think about it anymore because you're just so focused on the show.
You know, there's a exercise, maybe it's a short form game too, where you'd sort of pick a number out of a hat and you'd have that many seconds to do a scene, or the instructor or facilitator would know how many seconds you would have or minutes you would have, but you wouldn't. And so you would play past it. Whereas if you don't have those edits, particularly coming from the back line or from the outside, you have to keep going until it sort of moves naturally to the next.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, and editing depends on the form. It depends on the time that you have to do a show. It depends on how many people you have in the show. It's always going to be different every single time. The first thing I teach is don't make a big deal out of your edits. And then the last thing I teach is make a big deal out of your edits. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, don't start making a big deal out of it. Just get in there. Focus on what needs to be focused on. What's the most important thing? This scene is done. We need to get it to the next scene. Focus on that. Don't worry about people's feelings. Don't worry about any of that. Just get that scene, move the form forward. Then as you get more and more comfortable and you feel connected with each other, then you start messing around with that edit a little bit. Start having fun with it.
Before we leave the book, you guys chose to include the improv catacombs in your book. I thought that was a really interesting add to the book.
Yeah.
Some of the things we've already kind of talked about, like one of the things had to do with ironic detachment.
Uh-huh.
I do primarily, almost exclusively, short form. So the Grotto of Short Form Gnomes was not my favorite part about it. But but I think the criticisms that I think are inherent in those parts of the catacombs are valid criticisms in terms of if you're pursuing a high level of connected, authentic comedy, you can't have those things in there. And whether the form is long or short, or whether it is a Harold or a mono scene or whatever it is, these are more places that you can get stuck. And maybe some of them are the fact that it ends up being you just decide you're not going to put in the work, or you're happy with that cheap little laugh that you're able to get by going to, like you talked about early on,
yeah,
to those things that you always had in your back pocket.
I think that's a good point for me, where we just wrote the Catacombs because we had, like, we would text each other. Like, I remember texting Will, goes, I want there to be a premise dragon. We don't know what that is yet. We'll write it. But the idea of a premise dragon was funny to me. And the idea of a short form grotto was always funny to me. I think my tie into it is, yeah, just that I feel in the catacombs, there's a lot of my bad habits in there. So there's a little bit of me in there, kind of like, be careful there. Don't be careful. You're going to get caught here. Be careful. You're going to caught there. Keep checking yourself. Even at my age and my experience level, one of the reasons why I teach 101 still is it keeps me in contact with, oh yeah, that's right. Don't forget these beginning things. You do ask a lot of questions, or you do a lot of transaction scenes, or this or that. It's like, you know, pay attention. So I think it was more of a warning for us, that catacombs was in Will and mine's head, if you will.
One of the things was the sour veteran. Was that a phase that you felt like you had to kind of get through yourself, or more that you observed others having?
It's a general, I mean, there are archetypes in every improv theater. So sour veteran, especially, you know, when UCB started, it was in a really tiny hole in the wall. And we weren't expecting it to be a theater, you know, or a big thing. Now that it's a corporation, you tend to get more of these archetypes, and you see them over and over again. So that sour veteran you see a lot of, I think.
Yeah.
And there are many reasons for it. You know, some of them are very valid reasons, and some of them are, you know, yeah, I think you're transferring your problems onto other people and other things.
Right.
So it's a little bit of both. But you tend to see the same type of students, the same type of performers as the years progress. That's one of the things we noticed.
When you do a 101, do you guys do a show at the end of that for the students?
Yeah. Yeah, we do.
Yeah. And there's just something about a 101 show that is always kind of electric, I feel.
I absolutely agree. I tell them I've never had a bad 101 show. 401 shows, that's another thing. But 101 shows, they're always a blast because they're getting up there for the first time. There's joy.
Yeah, so somewhere along the way, part of that kind of rubs away or something.
Yes.
We want to capture that, bottle that, and keep pulling it forward. I think that's, you tell me, I think that's probably why you might be looking for that next form, or why you're trying to progress, because there is joy in knocking it out of the park and doing something new for the first time. And that's what 101 is.
Absolutely. That's probably why I like teaching it, you know? It's just seeing, first of all, I get to change these people's lives. I'm going to ruin their lives by making them love improv. Make them waste all their hobby time is now going to be involved in here.
Right.
I think you nailed it as far as new forms, developing new things. I'll give you an example. It just happened last week. I had several students email me and asked if I had seen the movie Midsommar. Have you seen that movie yet?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Well, several of them said, Billy, have you seen it? They're basically doing some of your exercises as pagan rituals. And it's like, well, that's because I stole those exercises from pagan rituals. That's where they came from. And I saw the movie because of my students said I had to see it. Then I walked out going, well, now I'm going to have to do this form. And it's a pagan ritual form. And I am so fortunate and lucky. I had a show here. It's a form show that's in the Inner Sanctum. So it's a very loose, casual show.
That's kind of like a small club
environment.
Yeah, it's like environment.
Attached with the UCB, the main compound. We have like 12 classrooms upstairs, the main theater downstairs, and to the left, to the right, a coffee shop with a big stage. I call it a poetry slam stage. It really has a delightful community college. That's what it feels like.
Okay.
So I do a little show there once a month where I work on a different form. And because of that email and because of that show, I said, well, let's try that out. And we developed a form right there on stage with all of my old students that got up and played. And it was just like, I was buzzing for 2 days afterwards. It's like, too bad there's no money in this. Because this is, I can just do this. Just come up with new ways to interpret forms and developing ideas. That would be so much fun. And it is, and that's what I do. It definitely keeps me young, I'll say that. Or immature, one of the two.
Both are good. Yeah, I just spoke today with someone that I kind of came up with in early classes and performed together with for many years. And we hadn't spoken in 2 or 3 years yet. You still have that inertia and that instant connection because of that creative process and going through. That's a lot of fun. And then if you get to do it again, so much the better.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that.
Well, Billy, I think we're at about time. Again, I really enjoyed, and as I said, I kind of entered with a bit of skepticism, not because of the source of it, but the structure. But I was won over, and that is not something that easily happens with me. But Pirate Robot Ninja, an improv fable, is available anywhere that you can find a browser, Amazon.com, and you have both a Kindle and a hard copy. I'm sure they're kind of flying off of wherever the distribution centers
are. They're flying off the computer shelves as we speak.
I've really enjoyed this time, and hopefully we get a chance to talk again sometime soon.
Absolutely.
So much good stuff in this episode. I love the simplicity of the note Billy shared. Just because they're laughing doesn't mean you're doing it right. Not going for the first laugh, but going for the best laugh is a good principle, not just for improvisers, but for comedians and communicators of all types. Your audience can guide you, but be aware of your craft and whether you're leaving some good stuff on the table. I wanted to give you a good flavor for Billy and Will Hines' book, Pirate Robot Ninja, and I hope I did that. But even if I did it really well, there's so much more for you to pick up by grabbing yourself a copy and going through it yourself. I'll put links to where to get the book and how to connect with Billy on the episode page at improvcomedyconnection.com, but you might as well go right to Amazon and type in Pirate Robot Ninja and you'll be good to go. If this episode has been useful to you, please spread the word, rate, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You think this could be more useful, or you have a great idea for a topic or a guest for a future episode, let me know. I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. It's been my pleasure to be your host on this episode of Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fish Sticks Comedy. You can check out Fish Sticks at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and I'll probably have an Etsy page out there somewhere for you to connect with me too. Thanks again for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.